This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
All right, I'm going to start with a prayer if that's okay. I need it and you may as well, so we'll start there and then we'll get going. Heavenly Father, we thank you that we're all able to be here tonight. Pray that you would be with us and be in us, that you would help us to hear your truth, that it would sink deeply within where it is. And if anything is spoken that is not true, that you would help us to forget it and you would forgive it. And we thank you, Lord, that you are with us and that you can move within a group of people to lead us towards you. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Okay, so work. It's Friday night. I don't know why you're all here. We should be forgetting about that. But hopefully this is a topic that is meaningful to all of you. I hope that we all take something away from it tonight. But really, it's a topic I've been interested in for a long time, since I started working, of understanding what is it all about? What is good work? And, you know, how can we pursue that? So I wanted to start with a quote that I found helpful in one of my reading. One of the books I read in preparation is called The Fabric of the World, by Lee Hardy. And in that quote, he says, "The institution of work is undeniably one of the chief integrators of persons in our society. It orients our lives, it organizes our time, it puts us in touch with people. Few of us want to be out of work, and yet we're not entirely sure if work is, in itself, a good thing. Some of us work only in order to live. Some of us live only to work, but most of us are somewhere in between, and our attitude toward work is divided accordingly." Now, I've been blessed with quite good work, I think, in most of my life, and yet I'm still have these questions about, you know, what is it enough? Is it good enough? Could it be better? Is it meaningful? Does it have eternal value? All of these questions. And I don't think that this is just my struggle. I think this is a struggle for all of us, because work is fallen. It's not perfect. We can look through all different ages. Say you're going to college. You're trying to decide on what you want to study, what you want to do. How do you evaluate that work, what you might be doing, what makes it good? Say we had one student, she was a recent graduate in graphic design. She just finished her first placement and was quite disillusioned with it. She just felt like I was just replacing words and images on pamphlets. Where's the meaning in that? And felt like she wanted to serve God and that was a different path. He seemed to be opposing. You know, some people are in their 30s, like myself, with a growing family, growing complexity of life, and even good work is a challenge to know how do you integrate that with all the demands and responsibilities of your life. Maybe you're later than that. You've gone into something and you didn't feel like you had much choice. I grew up in Michigan, a lot of folks working in the auto industry and factories, and I don't think there was a feeling of much choice and people evaluating, was this the right choice? Should I change? Should I keep going? Yeah, maybe you've had great success, and you're now questioning the motivations behind that or the effects on your family or something else. And maybe you're beyond our normal working years in retirement, and you're wondering what that's all about. Some people are smiling here. That's good. Is it okay to retire, to stop? Do you still owe it to society, to God, to keep being engaged? How do you do that? So I think this topic, the point being, I think covers all of us, and no matter where you're at, in my opinion. And I guess the desire in this lecture is for me to start to lay out a framework for how we can evaluate our work, how we can think about it, how we can, evaluate. So it's to say, is this good? Is this what could be improved? What needs redeeming in our work? And I think what's surprising, given the level of our concern about work, is that we don't often really pause to reflect on work itself very much. We're often thinking about ourselves. What are we going to do? What am I going to do? How am I going to be fulfilled? And so for that purpose, this lecture is not primarily about finding your vocation. It's not about that. This is a primer for that lecture, in essence, and think about work itself. How can we look at that? So just briefly, what do we mean by work? I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I like that it's a bit of a wide category. There are a lot of different types of it. Okay, I'm going to think it's that unique activity where we exercise the responsibilities of our social roles. Okay, and we have multiple roles in life, and that's part of my point here. Some of those are paid, some of those are not. Okay, I'm speaking as much to a stay-at-home mom or somebody who's caring for a loved one as I am to somebody who's a CEO of a company. All right, this is the work that those primary one or two activities which shape the majority of your time and your energy, and frankly, they are the things that we have to do whether we want to or not. So we're not talking about leisure tonight. We're talking about those duties and responsibilities that we have. So there's just a quick broad idea of work. So where are we going to go tonight? What questions are we asking? Four questions. All right. What story are we living in, and how does that affect our lives? So I think all of us live in stories, and those help us make sense of the discrete moments in our lives. Those bring them together, help us interpret what's happening in our lives and evaluate it. So we'll talk a little bit about worldview and story. Then we'll ask from there, what does good work look like? We're going to flesh out some criteria there, some three characteristics. Then we'll ask again, well, why isn't all this work good? What are the ways it goes wrong? And try to apply it lastly. How can we actually apply this? So we're going to start a bit broad, theoretical, and then work our way down to the practical and try to apply this to real life. So let's start with story. Which story are we living in? So one of the most fruitful ways I've found to think about work is the idea of worldview and story. So worldview, I'm sure most of you are familiar with this, but it's kind of our comprehensive framework and basic beliefs about life. It's the lens through which we see and interpret our lives, okay? Story is the aspect of that kind of pulls together all those bits. It gives us context, okay? So Tim Keller had a nice quote from one of his books. He says, our story may be the struggle of a just cause like saving the environment, or your personal quest to find true love or to be successful despite adverse social origins and expectations. Or perhaps the story is one of freedom and equality, in which you are bringing a family from an oppressive situation into a new country, a new life. Maybe the drama is one in which you forge your own unique sexual, cultural, or political identity against the prejudices of others. In each of these cases, you're putting yourself into a larger story that assumes that the world would be a better place if more people were doing what you were doing. So that may sound a bit theoretical as we think about the story, but if you listen to someone talk about their work, what I've found is that the degree to which they place that in a broader context, often indicates how much meaning they feel it has. The degree to which they feel it's part of something bigger, a bigger story in life, that they're actually doing anything. I've found this personally. If you ask me on a bad day what I had done, I'd often say, you know what, I just sit on conference calls and write emails all day. I'm just tapping the keyboard over and over and over again. You know, it was meaningless. It seemed devoid of all context and not wasn't connected to anything else. But on a good day, I would talk about, you can see these meanings grow. On a good day, I would talk about how I enjoy solving problems for clients and working with bright people. So we're connected one story up to those people around me. Or I might, on a really, really good day, talk about how I was working in the pharmaceutical industry or training people and helping physicians prescribe drugs that would save people's lives. All of a sudden, I've ramped up my story there to saving people's lives. It has societal impact. That was a really, really, really good day when I could make it that far with my evaluation. But it shows you that I think we're all living in these personal and cultural narratives. Some are conscious, known. Most of them, I think, are kind of subconscious, implicit narratives that we have. But I think the degree to which we believe or understand how our work fits into that narrative is going to affect our ability to find meaning in our work and to have a clear idea of how we should engage with it. Okay, so we want to be able to identify these stories we're living in. What do I think about? Well, how do I find meaning in my work? So let's look at, I'm going to try to touch on two dominant stories of our time. Okay. The first one, just kind of a general, this is kind of getting all of them in here, broad Western cultural narrative, is that of individual fulfillment. Okay. These are the stories, you hear it in a lot of different ways, but they typically involve some sort of journey towards self-actualization, self-esteem, self-acceptance. And many of these narratives that we have are full of very worthy endeavors. I want to point that out, some less so, but at the center of the story, and here's the point, is you. We are at the center. The individual is at the center. It's the story of my life that we're talking about. How often do you hear someone telling a child to pursue the dreams of their family or their nation? No. We say, pursue your dreams. What do you want to do? When's the last time you watched a movie about the main character decided it was better to conform to society what they thought was appropriate and good for it than to pursue their own dreams, to fulfill their identity? Think about your own life. Is there anything in the world that you would willingly submit yourself to? Is there anything or anyone that you would allow to direct, to orient your life, and at times whether you understood them or not? This idea of submission, I think, really reveals that idol of the individual for us. It almost feels wrong to put anything else at the center of our lives besides ourselves. And so my point here is not to claim that everyone everywhere is only thinking about themselves all the time. My point is that this is a general narrative that is the air we breathe, okay? This is, at least in Western culture, I think most people, most of the time, in most places, are taught to frame their lives around their own happiness or their own growth. Maybe you don't like that word happiness, but their own growth, progress, improvement, and I'm going to bucket that in fulfillment. Okay, this is so powerful, it's hard to even see at times. Now, sometimes that story does go beyond the individual. I want to recognize that. I think there's a growing and I think a wonderful concern for community and social justice that I see, and I think that should be encouraged. But what I find when you look at the people within a community, even within my own community, is they most often look like me. When I look around, they may be different on the outside, but on the inside, we tend to surround ourselves with people who have similar values and ideals. So when we're talking about the other, the community, even when we manage to elevate our stories above that, I think we're often just talking about our tribe, whatever that looks like, the people closest to us, those we choose that are like us. So the great problem society is trying to solve for here is basically anything that's getting in the way of that individual expression. And the great solution is freedom, that freedom, the pursuit of self-actualization. Now, understanding yourself and developing as a person, I think, are really good things, wonderful things. The problem is when they become ultimate things, when that is the final ultimate goal, that your final aim that you have. Okay, instead of being a fruitful outcome of a life well-lived, they become the core purpose, the driving purpose of finding that fulfillment. Okay, that's the point I'm making, is when it's not just a good outcome, but it's at the center. It's the decision-making criteria for your life. Where will I be fulfilled and grow? So I think even when we orient our lives towards good endeavors, like social justice or the concern for the poor, we risk these pursuits turning inward. They become a way of defining who we are, signaling our virtues to others, and satisfying our desire to live meaningful lives. I think it's interesting, if you think about it, even when we're seeking meaningful work, we're thinking about it being meaningful to us as opposed to the people we're working for and serving, which I think is quite telling there. So that's the story of individual fulfillment. Next, I want to talk about a more Christian story, what I'm going to call, I've heard called the two-chapter gospel, or I'll just say the two-narrow gospel that we have here. Okay, I think one of the things to point out is that you're there in the middle on this one, and the core problem here, my icon disappeared, is that you're still there. You may be invisible, but you're there on this one. And so this narrow gospel that we find here, I think this is one of the most dominant ways people think of and describe Christianity, and basically, we're talking about it identifies your personal moral sin as the main problem and our individual relationship with Jesus and the resulting access to heaven as the solution. The story begins at the fall and basically ends at redemption, at the cross. Okay, that's where we say the two-chapter gospel here. Now, our sin is central, okay, to the human predicament, and the cross is a true and pivotal moment in history. So the question, what's wrong with that? What's wrong that we have here? I'm going to pull a quote from Amy Sherman. She had a book, Kingdom Calling, where she analyzes this, and I think it was a really perfect analysis. She says, "The problem is that it focuses on the problem of personal sin only, thus intimating that sanctification, the process of becoming who God wants us to be, designed us to be, is a matter only of personal morality rather than that plus social justice. It focuses believers on getting a ticket to heaven and doesn't say much about their life in this world and what it should look like. Put differently, it focuses only on what we've been saved from and not telling us much about what we've been saved for. Okay? That makes sense. So, as I can see it, there are at least five negative effects, consequences of this. So firstly, I think it warps the character of God and his plan by giving you the sense that God has made a mistake in creating this world and us. Okay? If the trajectory is out of it in the end to heaven, and that's the goal is to get that ticket, there's this mistake of, well, what, why? What do we have here? Secondly, I think it gives a very kind of reduced idea of our core purpose, which is mainly about saving people from this world and maybe a bit about being a good person. And what we see is when escape becomes the ultimate goal, it can't help but to reduce the value of our lives here and now. Escape values speed, efficiency, and single-mindedness. So if we imagine our life as an office building, essentially the story starts with the assumption that the building's on fire and that there's only one exit door. Okay, why we're originally in the office is less than clear in this story. Okay, but the loving thing to do is now obvious. That's get as many people out as quickly as possible. Any tactic goes, because the main thing is that everyone agrees that a fire door exists and they know where it is. All other activities pale in comparison to the life-saving work of evacuation that we have here. I think fourthly, the danger is that it devalues creation itself, the broader value there. It's hard to see the value of creational stewardship or cultural renewal and reformation when everything disappears in the end. The non-human creation is seen kind of as a backdrop for our lives. It's like a stage prop that, yeah, we can't let it go completely to seed because we need it as the backdrop, but inherently, it doesn't have much value. Okay? And then most harmfully, what I've talked about, is that it's all about us. Christianity and salvation become about us. The Bible teaches that salvation isn't an end in itself. It's an absolutely necessary part of God's plan to redeem and renew all of creation. It's not just a wonderful plan for my life. It is that. But it's a wonderful plan for the whole world here. All of creation. All right, so that's our too narrow, our two-chapter gospel. So what's the alternative then? What's the biblical story? So you may have heard these terms before, but I think the two meta-narrative, the grand biblical narrative, can be summed up in this: creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. Okay? And I'll talk through each of these and what they are in a moment here. But I really like this framework for situating us in the big picture. So in creation, let's walk through them one by one and see if we can follow this along. In creation, we see that God made the world and everything in it was good. And our purposes and responsibility, well, one note here is, as I go through these, I'm going to focus on their relationship to work, okay? So as we go through here, there are so many things we can unfold from using these categories. I'm focusing on work, so as you're listening, I'm sure you will think, well, that's not the full story. That definitely am not telling the full story. But so creation reveals our purposes and responsibilities as co-workers with God. And in that, I'm going to go through these probably quicker than I should, but I just want to get some truths to ground ourselves in as we go through the rest of the lecture here. So we see that God himself is a worker, okay? He's a creator God. He rested from his work on the seventh day. We were created to work. That is not a post-fall condition. It's not. It was cursed in the fall, but it was there beforehand. So this is something that I find surprising how often it is surprising to people when we talk about this. Thirdly, we talked about this, and I'm going to hammer this home all night. We are not here primarily for ourselves, but rather to cooperate with God in the development of his creation. And this is all, right now, we're all in Genesis here. Our work is both physical and intellectual. Naming, think of the naming of the animals, as well as the tending of the garden and developing it. And again, we're working in partnership with others. Man is not meant to be alone, okay? This pursuit in life is not just about you, so there's creation. Now the fall. Now we start to see this cosmic scope of our sin and idolatry. In the fall, we see the whole world's fallen from its perfectly good state and is affected by sin. There's not one aspect that's more or less affected by that sin. The whole of creation is affected here. Us internally, personally, morally, and all aspects of creation. Okay, so the problem here isn't just that our original parents broke a rule. But I think if you broaden this out, this is the idea that they left their original vocation as God's co-workers and stewards over all creation, working with and for God, in favor of, you could say, becoming independent entrepreneurs, free to pursue their own plans as they please. And I think it's helpful to widen out a view of what happened in the Garden of Eden beyond just, oh, they broke a rule. We were responsible for creation. Therefore, so many of the effects of sin and the fall make sense when you think about that. We were supposed to hold them, and we turned away from God in that. So our work is going to be subject to pain and futility. That's probably the point I need to hammer home least tonight. We know that. We know that. Anybody who has worked for more than a day knows that. Creation itself is against us. So again, enslaved to decay in the sense that it is subject, that Paul says the whole creation is groaning, subject to bondage and decay. Okay? We were meant to have authority over that, so it makes sense it's been created. And then we also see, again, this idea of pointlessness and meaninglessness, at least apart from God, and that our motives for work are broken. And then to kind of summarize that, this work is often dehumanizing. Okay? It's not fulfilling our capacities. And then one, we don't often talk about hopeful points in the fall. And one of the things I find helpful about it is that it gives us the ability to lament and be angry about the way the world is sometimes, because we know that's not how it's meant to be. So when we think about work, this is helpful to say, actually, it wasn't meant to be this painful. It wasn't meant to be futile. Here we have. All right. I need to speed up here. All right, now we're at redemptive history. This point of redemption. God is working in history through his people, and that culminates in the person and the God of Jesus Christ. He saved all of creation with his death and resurrection for the purposes of making all things new. So Christ's work is restorative, and it affects the whole of creation. Secondly, we play a pivotal role in that, okay? We're not just the recipients of it. We have a role in that ongoing area, and it affects every area of our life. And then we're not alone. Just say that we're given the Holy Spirit. We're given the example of Christ. And I think that we are, you know, at the end of the day, God is ultimately responsible for this. So God's sovereignty is important to hold in that. As I'll really go here tonight, I'm going to talk a lot about our responsibility, but at the end of the day, he's holding all this. It's his project of redemption that we're asked to participate in, if that makes sense. All right, and lastly, what I would call restoration or new creation. So this is best understood, I think, when you say the renewed creation that we have here, that one day God's kingdom will come in its fullness, but it's already begun in our hearts and our lives here. The new heaven and the new earth, again, like I said, should be understood as a renewed heaven and earth. So it's not just that the earth is totally obliterated, nothing's there. We're given this sense of continuity, that it's refined, that goes through that fire. But the idea, our labor is not in vain, okay? It's going to find a place in the new creation. We know that the victory is already won, but we're living, as we saw, in that kind of now and not yet area. The fact that there is this new creation means that what we do now is given value, eternal worth, okay? It's not just going to disappear all in the end. We don't know how this works. I want to be very humble in this, that it's not an obvious kind of, oh yeah, I've got totally figured out what this new creation is going to look like. But we're given hints at it. We're given ideas. And then I think lastly, the idea that this insight into the future should shape some of our responses in the present. So again, we see that this biblical narrative, it gives us our purpose. It sets expectations. It defines problems we have, and it gives directions to how we participate in that. It's the context in which we can see, interpret, and direct our lives. So the first step in reframing our idea of work is to see it in the right story. See, our story flows into God's story, not the other way around. It's not that his story is flowing into ours and he's helping us along. He's not my co-pilot, okay? We're going into his story. All right. Now let's look at what good work looks like here. What were we created for? So firstly, I'm going to very quickly just talk on our job title. If we're talking about work, you might know, we know what kind of organization and movement we're part of now, but what's your job title? And this is very Christian or religious sounding language here, very archaic. So let's try to flesh out, what does it mean, the idea when Peter talks about us being a royal priesthood. Okay, and you see this even in Genesis, that Adam is kind of prefigured as a priest, and the royalty part as kind of a kin and part of God's kind of rulership. So anyways, we'll talk about this idea of stewardship or stewards, okay, as royal priests. This is that royal part. When we read those rules like subdue, those words like subdue, rule, have dominion, these are all talking about us being God's representatives on earth, that we are called to reflect the Creator's wise stewardship into the world. Creation is our responsibility with God, and we're given the power and gifts to carry that out. So I'm going to think about responsibility and stewardship in this category. All right. Secondly, when you think about priests, this idea of mediators. Okay, a mediator is someone who stands between two parties that are at odds and seeks reconciliation. Okay, so we join Christ in his priesthood as in the reconciliation between God and creation. And in order to do this well, the point I want to call out is that you need to know both parties. You need to know God. What is he like? What does he want? So that you can rule well and join. And you need to know creation. You have to be engaged with it so you know what needs redemption, what needs to be reconciled. So we can't just do, I'm just going to focus on God here and leave the world behind here. And we can't just focus on the world and not pay attention to God, okay? And then the idea of worshipers, again, something that usually we think worship, that belongs on a Sunday, but no, this idea of worship is the idea of to show the worth of something, okay? So when we say part of our role is as worshiper, it means that we are people who know the value of Christ, who follow him, and who proclaim that, his virtues, and all that we say and do. Our lives are our worship here, okay? Implicitly and explicitly. That involves reflecting who God is. We have to know him. And proclaiming it. All right, so stewards, mediators, and worshipers. Hopefully this gives some context. N.T. Wright summarized it really well. He said, this role, the royal priesthood, is the people who are called to stand at the dangerous but exhilarating point where heaven and earth meet, reflecting the Creator's wise stewardship into the world and reflecting the praises of all creation back to its maker. Okay, so royal priests. All right, so let's get into good work here. I'm going to talk about three characteristics of good work. All right, cultivation, service, and becoming human. It's a nod to you, Randall. All right. And actually, we had a lot of different ways, but they all sounded personal growth, and that sounded, too, again, fulfilling. So I love it. It's becoming human. That's what it's about. So cultivation, service, and becoming human. So cultivation, what do I mean by this? Cultivation means that the primary direction of our work is to care for and develop God's good creation. So in Genesis, we see what is often referred to by theologians as the cultural or creational mandate. And this gathers together the direction and the purposes that God have and that they gave to Adam and Eve in the garden. Al Walters put it that we are to bring, if you want to summarize this creational mandate, we're to bring to fruition the possibilities of development implicit in the work of God's hands. So we're to bring to fruition the possibilities of development implicit in the work of God's hands. God's creation, what this means is God's creation, even though it was good and perfect, is not a static reality. There's a sense in which it continues to unfold. Its potential is undeveloped. And we're called to engage and participate in that ongoing creational work. That involves filling and stewarding. I want to pull out kind of four areas that involves, okay? So that involves care, all right, that it's our responsibility to care for creation. The idea of developing it, which I just said, kind of unleashing that potential that there is. In order to do that, as I just call it, we have to understand. So part of this category of cultivation is those endeavors which seek to understand the world. How does this work? How does, when we look inside of objects, what's going on? And that helps us to care for and develop the world. And that involves everything at the end of the day. All of creation is part of that, right, that we need to engage in. So that's cultivation. And these three categories are kind of the center, if you will, of what we're going to be talking about tonight. So cultivation. Next one, service. Okay, that the primary motivation and function of all of our work is to serve God by serving our neighbors. All right, there's two ways, as I see it, that in which God's will is done on earth. Either directly, as we see with Israel and in the desert when manna comes, or indirectly through the involvement of human responsibility. So God could choose to always work directly in creation. Okay? He could give us our children. He didn't have to give us mothers and fathers to create children, all right? But he gave us that role in creation. And I think there's a quote from a book called God at Work, which sums this up very, very well. Okay? And that's the idea. And this is kind of the idea that God uses humans to care for creation. It says, when we pray the Lord's Prayer, observed Luther, we ask God to give us this day our daily bread. And he does give us our daily bread. He does it by the means of the farmer who planted and harvested the grain, the baker who made the flour into bread, the person who prepared our meal. And we might add today the truck drivers who hauled the produce, the factory workers in the food processing plant, the warehouse men, the wholesale distributors, the stock boys, the lady at the checkout counter, also playing their part are the bankers, the future investors, the advertisers, lawyers, agricultural scientists, mechanical engineers, and every other player in the nation's economic system. All of them were instrumental in enabling you to eat your morning bagel. He's from New York, apparently. That's good. So the idea here, again, is that we're brought under God's providential care here. We bring people, I should say, under God's providential care in our work. All right, and just as God equips Christians for the building up of Christ's body, the church, so he also dispenses gifts and talents for the equipping and building up of the human community. So the idea that we are part of a body in this, and each part is necessary to do this well, okay? We're used to thinking of kind of the helping professions as service, as loving others, but that's a reduced version here. But when you look at that list I just read through, all of that is involved in providing and serving others, okay? And I love in when Paul talks about this metaphor of the body, he talks about how each part is necessary for the whole to function, and no one gets to say, I don't need you. And then he goes on to say, which I think is beautiful, the idea that it's actually just the opposite, that there some parts are trying to raise themselves above the other, that I'm really serving here. But actually, he says, no, it's just the opposite. The quote-unquote lower parts, the more basic, the more necessary. Okay? You can live without an eye, but not without a stomach. And Paul doesn't even stop there. He even says that those parts of the body that we think less honorable, we still bestow the greater honor. I think he's fighting to ensure that we don't create another hierarchy of gifts and roles. All are needed. So, and this is, again, I'm going to hammer home, all of creation is served in this way. All right, so lastly, of the three, so that was service. Primary function to serve God. Now we're on to becoming human. So the primary personal outcome of our work is the process of becoming the type of people we were created to be. So that process of shaping and us into the type of people existed, and point this out, existed before the fall as well. One scholar put it, the garden is a microcosm of the whole creation, a testing ground, as it were, for humankind and its role for ruling all over all things. So while our focus now is often much more on fighting brokenness, and being involved in redemption and reconciliation, we were never created as fully formed static individuals. Again, there was always this idea of growth, potential for eternal growth and development. Okay, so the first point I want to make is that this is the only characteristic that's focused on ourselves, and even then, it is an outcome, okay, and a process. It's not the aim or a final, complete, static destination of our work, meaning that we should invite this and appreciate it and pray for this process along the way, but we aren't choosing our work primarily because of what it's going to do for me, how it's going to develop me. So it's an outcome of good work, that we become more human, we're shaped. And I want to talk about this in three ways, this ongoing process of growing in capacity and character through the Spirit of God. And I'm going to say that the first is, you can think of this as practicing virtues, fighting vices, and developing our capacities. So when we think about work, it's a uniquely challenging and rich environment for this process, precisely because it's usually the one place where we're not choosing who we're with or even what we're doing. It's a challenging place to be. Okay, these people, there is friction in many, many different ways. All right, and this makes it a good place to practice virtue. Okay, and if we think about this area of work as an environment for growth, we then realize that personal development doesn't does it mainly happen through gathering knowledge? And we can fall into this, the idea like, I know what justice is, therefore I'm just. That's not how it works. Or I believe God exists even, therefore I trust him, or I have faith in him. There's a difference there. We need to live into this. Our growth and development come through putting ideas and belief into action. You becoming something necessitates a doing, okay? And work, I think, is a beautiful environment for this. Painful, but good in doing that. So what do I mean by practicing virtues? Getting ahead of myself here. Basically, you think about it, that we have the opportunities to practice virtues in order to become good. For example, I'm courageous when I act courageously, but I can't act courageously unless I'm put into some sort of risk or danger. Okay? Or a teacher needs a rowdy student in order to practice patience. I was very patient before I had children. I just wanted you to know that. You know, but a businessman, the same thing. He's not just by kind of associating with a cause. He's just when he does the right thing and it's not to his benefit. That's when he becomes just in that way. Or fighting vices. So we fight those not primarily by avoiding temptation, although I think that's necessary often, but by growing in goodness and self-knowledge. So it's very tempting for Christians to seek moral purity by creating safe spaces. So we think that if we avoid the world, we're not worldly. But that's not the case. We know that our brokenness is within us. Wherever you are, there you are. Wherever you go, there you are. Sorry. So our ability to heal from and shed wrong behavior is contingent upon opportunities to choose rightly. Okay, if you want to fight a tendency in your workplace or a tendency towards envy, pray for an opportunity to work with somebody who's better than you at that work. Okay, if you want to deal with your pride, seek honest feedback. It's very humbling. I don't want much of that after this, just to be all over there. All right, and lastly, I think where we find that work is particularly rich, because you can see those areas would happen in all of life, okay, is I think when we think about developing capacities, okay? So in the same way, we can only identify and grow in capacities as we have the opportunity to practice them. So this list, just to say, this isn't a systematic overview of all capacities of human being. These are examples. These were actually most of these were the core competencies that my former workplace, we worked on defining the core capacities or competencies we needed for people to be successful. Things like focus, self-leadership, collaboration, communication, problem-solving, decision-making, flexibility. And you can expand upon that infinitely. Different type of work needs different competencies. But the point is that if you're going to practice these, you need opportunities. You can watch every YouTube in the world on fixing a sink, but you need to actually fix a few sinks before you can claim any sort of competency. I need to fix a lot more sinks around here before I can... John will tell me I have any sort of competency. Or think about management. You can read all the books on management in the world, but you're not going to become a good manager until you try to manage people and probably fail quite a few times. And I think Jesus had a great way of talking about this. He told several parables about what I would call the idea of progressive responsibility. So when he's talking, think about the parable of the talents, for example, or seeking the lower seat. And when he ends these by saying, if you have been faithful with a few things, I will put you in charge of many things. So there's this emphasis on humility and faithfulness in small things, and that will lead to greater opportunities. So work is this place to discern our strengths and where we can be useful to other people. That's where we start to find these things out. But I think as at least my generation, as an entitled generation, we usually often demand that our work should begin by engaging us at our full capacity. And the assumption there is that, one, we have a huge capacity in the skill, and that we have the character to actually handle a lot of responsibility. I think often we may have certain skills or knowledge, but we lack the character at that point, and we need to grow into that. So Christ teaches us the opposite, that we should concentrate on being faithful with what you've been given, and then much more will be given. Okay. Now, God will surely help us in this process. My point is that I don't think the normative method for God dealing with us is zapping us with virtue or beaming sin out of us or just handing skill to us. Work is a place for practicing and becoming. All right. So we talked about cultivation, about caring for and developing God's good creation. We talked about the idea of service, of work as serving God by serving our neighbor, and now we just talked about becoming human, our becoming the type of people. So that demands the question of we talked about what we're doing, what these look like, but what is the actual result? And very simply, I think the results should be those results that lead towards life and flourishing. Again, a very broad category because we need it to be broad. Okay, this involves the whole of life, all of our work. So in cultivation, particularly, we see the flourishing of creation. In service to others, we see the flourishing of others. And I think in that area of becoming human, we see ourselves flourishing in good work. God created life, it was good. Jesus came to give us life and life eternal. So we're made to reflect that life-giving energy into our work as his co-creators. All right, but we know that all of our work, this is pretty grandiose statements I'm making about work, but it's not all like that. So why isn't it like that? I want to point out three ways that I see work kind of being distorted. So as we disobey and we pursue our own endeavors, so we have these three kind of opportunities in cultivation, service, and becoming human. But I think there's three main ways in which work is distorted as well. And so first, the direction or outcome of work can range anywhere from neutral to negative, but instead of life-giving and flourishing, it moves the other direction. Okay, you may be a great teacher, but if you're teaching people to manipulate customers to make a sale, regardless of their need, you're diminishing the customer, you're probably wasting creational resources, and you're potentially harming yourself, your own conscience, okay? So the direction, where is our work actually going? What's it producing? All right, that's one way we've got to think about it. It can be warped. Secondly, the design or structure of work, okay? That these things can be, you know, if we don't have all these characteristics of cultivation, service, and becoming human, when they're missing, it becomes distorted. And just think about, I want you to think an easy one to pick on here, and we'll talk about factory worker twice in this lecture because I also want to redeem it a bit. But if you're in a work in a factory making bifurcated needles, so these helped eradicate smallpox, all right? The service you have is incredibly valuable, actually, okay? You're literally saving lives. But the work itself, the design of that work, is literally designed to remove your responsibility and your creative abilities, okay? The idea is to remove that choice action and you get put into an assembly line to do the same thing over and over. You're seen as a machine here. Okay, so the structure, the design there is what's wrong. It's not that everybody who works in a factory creates bad things. It's the design of the work itself. Okay, and I think if we think about royal priesthood, that role, then work needs to be designed in such a way that it gives workers as much responsibility as they can be given. Okay, that's not saying we're purely autonomous workers doing everything. But again, so the direction, what an outcome of work, the design or structure of it, and then lastly, the motivation. Okay? We saw this in the narrative of personal fulfillment and salvation. Okay? Even when the structure and outcome are generally positive, we may experience it to be meaningless because all we can see is our own part of the whole. It's about us. And we may not flourish because we lack the patience to grow in our responsibilities. We need to learn how to see when our motivation comes away from the Creator and we start to put it on something in creation, okay? Whether it's about myself, whether it's about my family, okay? This is called idolatry. Whenever it's our prime motivator, those things can't, anything in creation can't handle the pressure, all right, of that being the sole motivator and reason for things, all right? We need to situate ourselves in God's story. That's the idea here. Okay, so these are three ways, these categories in which work is fallen, okay, that it goes around. So, and as we start to apply this framework, I think we'll see that all work is affected by this. There's not, that the end of this lecture, in a sense, the reason I developed this lecture is because it's complicated, it's complex. It's to try to deal with the fact that all work in some ways is broken, and all work, almost all work, at least there's maybe a few we could think of which are really hard, are totally okay, they're just awful. There's nothing redemptive about them. All right, all work is this mix, and we need to figure out how to discern it so we don't just say, oh, I didn't like that work, it's bad, it's meaningless, it wasn't meaningless to me, or that work is great, that's perfect, so if I just go do that, then everything will be okay. That's what we try to do in our lives, is black and white thinking about work, but really it's complex. So these give us some categories that we're going to start dealing with, these works. So that leads us into how do we actually apply this, all right? Yeah, it's pretty exciting. I was pretty excited about that one. I did nothing, actually. I just did that, and I was pretty excited about it. So, all right, so the first, the thing as we, before we apply these to, we're going to use two different kind of situations to apply this framework, but what we need to remember is that we need to hold all three of these, this cultivation, service, and becoming human together as different but equal, or equal but different, okay? So when we, and the other part, think of them as parts of a whole is another way to think about that. All right, while different types of work may lean towards cultivation or towards service, all different types of work are needed for society to function and for creation to flourish. So if you think of these as three pillars holding up a structure, if one is removed, we don't value that, then the whole structure either collapses or is near collapse. Okay? If we can't hold together, them together in value, we fail to see the bigger picture. We need infrastructure for transportation and utilities. We need technologies that heal, teach, and feed. We need farmers. We need art that captures and communicates the reality of our existence. We need helping professions that bring people back into society. And we need governments that bring law and order to our communities. If we don't hold them together, we're just going to create another hierarchy of work. We've seen so many of them. For instance, I see this often with younger people, quite idealistic. You see the hierarchy, I would call, of social justice of service. So we prioritize service above cultivation and becoming human. We end up with this hierarchy of values where work that directly serves somebody is better than everything else. Okay, and the more selfless, the better. Profit, wages, any other material personal gain, those just diminish the purity of this service work up here. And it's developed this unrealistic and potentially dishonest expectation of selflessness that then leads to, I think, often people abdicating their own responsibility to take care of themselves. And it often develops a posture of self-righteous judgment. So ironically, the very people who usually whose work supports and funds those charities are looked down on as being selfish. Okay, so you get this hierarchy of, okay, yeah, nonprofit or charity works here. If it's international, that's the best, because then you're far away from home and you're miserable. But domestic's pretty good as well, okay, because you're still self-sacrificing, you don't make any money. All right, and you just work your way down from there. And you have this hierarchy that almost nobody gets to participate at the top. Okay, but in reality, for those people to actually have that work, all these other roles and work need to be happening. Okay, does that make sense, that idea of hierarchy in that way? All right, so that's the principle. We have to hold them all together. So now let's actually look at this. So we talked about a few different people at the beginning. I made some broad sweeping statements about people at different ages, and we talked about a graphic designer who is actually an example of this. We have a few graphic designers here, so you know, hopefully what I'm saying is true. And then I also want to think about a factory worker. Again, I grew up in southern Michigan, where I had lots and lots. That's the heart of the auto industry in America. And so most of the people in my community even were employed in some way or another in this industry and working in factories. So it was a very real reality for me. So I want to think about these two types of work. I want to apply these categories. So think about where sin might be distorting the outcomes or the design and the motivation of work. And then we're going to identify opportunities in each of those for cultivation, service, and becoming human. So the hope is that this is going to be both challenging and encouraging. Okay, this whole lecture, I want it to challenge us, to push us, but I also want it to encourage us in what we're doing. So let's think about the graphic designer. Okay. So again, if we remind ourselves, she came here, she had just finished her first placement, was very disillusioned, it was boring, it seemed meaningless, and she's trying to integrate her desire to her beautiful desire, listening to her talk, to serve God with this work of graphic design, and they just seem like two opposite paths. Okay? So when we're thinking about this, the first thing is, okay, what are the possible distortions? So we talk about direction or outcome. What's the outcome here? Well, obviously, it depends on the content a little bit, graphic design, what you're designing, but I think it was pretty safe to say that she was in the area, she's not designing, you know, kind of awful, I won't go through all the things you could design, but I think it was most likely helpful to her clients. It may have been boring to her, but those pamphlets were easier to read at the end of the day. They helped people get to the content that they needed. So you don't have an awful content. I think you have an awful outcome. I think you have a pretty good direction of this work in graphic design. I'll flesh this out a little bit more as we go. So on direction, outcome, I think she's pretty good. Pretty good. I think on design, as somebody who led a team of graphic designers in my work, I would say that the design and structure of graphic design work is often quite good. It's very flexible. Okay, you can work from many different places. You can go to many different cities and find work. I think it's a fairly good type of work, the structure. There's the potential for isolation, but you can work through that in other areas of life. You might develop bad posture, but just get a stand-up desk, you'll be okay. So again, the structure of the work. You know, we're thinking through how could this go wrong. Structure is fairly positive here, I think, of graphic design. I think it's the motivation in this case where we start to see the particular temptation and brokenness. Of what I've seen over and over, and just to be clear, this category of motivation is quite personal and subjective. So everybody's different. So I'm not trying to say that every graphic designer ever is going to be like this. Just trying to make there are some tendencies I think we can see in different industries. And within graphic design, as someone who employed them and worked with them, what I saw is that especially young graphic designers coming out of art school, there's this strong emphasis on personal expression and experimentation and originality. So they're evaluating these jobs based on how much freedom they'll have to design what they want, what they think is good, and not on the job itself. What are we actually doing in that job? So there's this temptation to think primarily about what am I getting out of it. So motivation turns towards themselves. So these are our three kind of potential distortions that we have here. So now let's, on a positive way, let's move towards cultivation. So where does graphic design help creation and people flourish? So if you think about it, I really think graphic design actually does quite a bit of cultivation and creation. So the goal of it is to take these raw materials of content and images and make something that's both beautiful and intelligible. These are the goals of cultivation, taking something in creation, making it better, developing it, making it more useful, more beautiful, or more arresting, more intelligible. You're helping people communicate. So that is creating order often out of chaos. If you've gotten the PowerPoint decks I've gotten from people, you're creating order out of chaos in that. So service. Again, I think good design really does help and serve people. All right, so think about, just think about websites you've gone on. If you go to a very poorly designed website, it's very difficult to find the information you need. Or on the extreme side, road signs. This sounds simple, but this is design and graphic design. If you can't tell where you're going, people can die. If you don't know where the emergency room is, okay, bad design actually can truly cause death. That seems extreme, but I've heard stories of this, okay, where you just have poor design, poor graphic design, you can't understand what you're doing. So this really is a matter of flourishing towards life, or it could be towards death, okay? So I think graphic design really does help people. Good design helps people. And then I think this idea of becoming human, all right? So what are the opportunities here? All right, and I think when we had this idea of practicing virtues, fighting vices, and developing your capacities, this again is a category where all work participates in this, I think. Some it's less a little bit, but you're going to have opportunities to develop virtues. If you're dealing with clients who know nothing about design and what looks good, but are going to tell you what to do, what looks good, you're going to have to try to develop, you know, kind of courage and endurance and perseverance and hearing that. Okay, we talked about that pride issue of thinking, well, I know what's good. Can you kind of put the other above yourself in this case of saying, well, this is your project. You know the content, not me. All right, I'm going to fight my desire to have control here and serve you. I'm going to follow your path here, your design ideas. And then capacities, again, it depends on the situation. This is where I think this student's desire maybe to find new work was valid, because it seemed she was not being challenged in any way. It was so simple that her whole degree, having studied for 4 years, did in some ways seem to be wasted in the type of graphic design she was doing, but that's not always the case. And that's where it depends on the situation. It's am I going to get to grow, be given opportunities to develop my capacities for both design and managing others and communicating? This is what we're talking about. So that's just kind of an attempt to apply the framework to a graphic designer. let's take the kind of the last bit here and just apply it to a factory worker. Very different situation, okay? We have somebody, let's, this is a fictional person, but say that they it didn't, again, a lot of people that I knew, they didn't have much choice in their work, okay? They're questioning the value of it. Should they be seeing something else? But even if they don't love it, it has supported their family. So is that enough? All right, so let's try to think. These are the types of questions we ask ourselves. All right, and I'm not going to presume to answer that question for everybody here. The point is I want to give you all this framework, these categories, to start to flesh it out for yourselves, okay, and discern that. How is your work? So, again, factory worker, directional, possible distortion of the outcome of the work. Again, this might seem it might seem obvious to others of you, and maybe not, but at the end of the day, while vehicles, you know, maybe there's too many of them on the road and they create pollution, at the end of the day, for the factory worker on the assembly line, that's not their problem right there, because they're not the engineers in that case, or the marketers who are convincing people to buy this. They're dealing with, they're creating vehicles which are very, very, very vital and important to our society. Again, it's this idea, it may seem basic, but actually it's core and fundamental to how the world works right now. So it is really a good outcome in that way. All right. So the design of the work, this is where it's more obviously, I think we see a distortion. Okay, there's huge strides have been made since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in improving the structure of factory work. I'm going to say that. But I think it still remains relatively inhumane in the sense that it's still designed to remove that personal responsibility and creativity all for the sake of efficiency. Okay, that's the problem there, is that you're taking these God-given, I think, desires and need to have some sort of responsibility and creative action, and you pull that away. Just do what you're told over and over and over again. That's going to be pretty dehumanizing, I think. And then motivation, again, a very personal one, but I think here, you know, the temptation is going to be less to find their identity in work and more, I think, for it to become purely instrumental, okay? That it's only about what I get out of my work. So I'm not even going to think about the cars that I make or the quality of them. I'm getting a paycheck, probably because it's so awful in some ways. I get a paycheck, that's good. So this fails to recognize that intrinsic value of the work. Cars are a blessing. Now, I know people who woke up every day hating their work, but continued to do it for their family. On the one hand, I want to affirm that as a beautiful motivation. But on the other hand, we still have to lament that the design of the work is so distorted that any intrinsic satisfaction is difficult to find. And then maybe, in great gentleness and humility, we need to challenge and ask whether this is motivated more by the security of the job, really, than this other self-sacrificial love for the family. Is it because you don't trust that there could be other opportunities out there? Do we need to push somebody in that way? So, motivation. Deeply personal, but something we need to examine in that way. And then lastly, we get to these potential opportunities. So when it comes to, while industry on a whole is a great example in some ways of cultivation, of creating kind of new things in creation, it quite literally takes raw material and creates something new out of it. The assembly line worker, again here, doesn't have opportunities for creative stewardship in the industry. That's been stripped out of their hands. That design and planning have been given over to experts and managers. So in that way, I think that we don't see much opportunity for cultivation for practicing this. Maybe when they're restructuring a plant, they will consult a person. So at points in time, but there's going to be less opportunity here. Service, we talked about that. Cars are useful, okay? We can't forget that. I think, and then when it goes to being human, again, we see the distorted design of the work here start to limit how engaging this is to their full human capacities. Of course, there will be opportunities to practice the virtue of fortitude as they seek each day to do good work or to fight greed when they have opportunities for overtime at the expense of their family. Now, I know of no work that completely removes the opportunities for sanctification in this regard. That's one of the more encouraging conclusions I've come to in thinking this through. That God can use all of these situations for the good of those who love him. Okay? Another point of encouragement is that if we have work that is not using all of our creative and responsible energy, then I think we can find other opportunities outside of our primary paid work. Okay? And that kind of leads me into, it's like literally three sentences to leave you with as we discuss this. Okay? And that I want you to ponder as you think about this. I think this will hold this in balance a little bit. And that's, first, your value and your identity are not given through your work. Okay? It's important, it's central, but these things come from God alone. Any other source is going to collapse under their weight. So if you're trying to find that in your work, it will not bear the burden. Okay? Secondly, your work will not contain everything in it that it means to be human. Okay? It's not going to satisfy all your needs, your paid work or unpaid work. You need to examine the full reality of your life before you become too discouraged by the limitations of your particular paid work. Okay? So if you're looking to be ultimately engaged on all levels in your work and disappointed that it's not happening, I think you're going to continue to be disappointed as you go through life. All right? And lastly, you have full permission to lament the distortions of your work. Okay? Sometimes this is all we can do in a particular moment. The Christian faith allows us to look at our life and say with tears in our eyes that this is not the way it was meant to be. Okay, and sometimes lament is okay. And we need to be there and say, this is frustrating. This is dehumanizing. Don't like that. So I think if we can hold these three things together, that will allow us from maybe raising work up too much, all right, and forgetting other areas of life. But hopefully this lecture was useful to you in some way, and maybe we can take some time now to discuss if you have any questions. I went 5 minutes over. I'm going to take that as a success. Tonight. No. So there you are, work. So we had, I'll put up this so we can think about those kind of categories that we had of direction, design, motivation, cultivation, service, being human. Edith. Yeah.
I like your emphasis on not focusing too much on selfishness and things, but you touched a little bit on the word flourishing. Can you unpack a little bit more what flourishing might look like?
That was my small slide, Edith. That was the yeah. So what are I talking about flourishing in this case? Well, I think I would say it's linked to that what we talked about in that becoming human side, or at least for humans in that case of kind of growing into who you're created to be, this idea of we have all these different capacities that we're capable of doing. And I think it's does this, so if we think of different types of work leading to flourishing, again, I think the idea that, let me go to a different example besides, so if you're an entrepreneur, okay, there are lots of different products which you can create a business that will produce those, but thinking about, okay, is this product going to mainly distract someone from their lives? Okay, or is it going to help them engage with their lives, engage with relationships? Okay, is it going to bring them towards people, or is it going to help them isolate, become isolated? So I would say the more they're engaged with the relationships, the more they're starting to flourish, they're being human in that way. If you're giving them something that just pulls them away all the time, we need to think about that. It's not to say that, you know, Netflix isn't inherently evil, because it distracts people. But when we're thinking about what types of products or work to do, what's it going to do? What's it going to pull out? There's a lot of people creating products like that, to be honest. So as Christians, I would say, what can we ask that next question of, not what can I sell, but what would be good for people? Okay. So there's books that have been written on the idea of flourishing and giving life. Does anybody have any particular, do you have any thoughts on what that might be?
Enlarged,
yeah.
Somehow I think with the way in which you describe flourishing has something to do.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, you're enlarged. And I think that's what you see, the sense of like cultivation and creation flourishing. That's that. Instead, it's developing. It's become, we're not meant to stay in the garden or return to the garden. You know, we're given a vision of a city coming down. So this idea of going from the garden to the city, this development. So creation itself is, we're building on it. We're finding these possibilities for it to unfold. So I think that's an idea in creation of it unfolding, that idea there. Yeah?
I've got two points that are a bit related. One is sometimes people go through a situation which means they have to reevaluate everything that's happened to them up to that point as their job changes, and that can be quite. When I was young, I went to Vauxhall Motors and I was watching them produce these cars like in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And there's one guy, he's spending all his time riveting on the front door of a Vauxhall Victor. Went past him, and that's all he did. And I said to the manager, doesn't he ever do anything else? He said, well, yeah, every 3 weeks he's reaching to the left front door instead of the right front door. And I thought, right, that's not really very meaningful. Yeah. And now, and you go back there now, and it's just all robots doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, so, and they had a production line for engines that had 110 men on it, and there was a new one that thought had 2 men on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those people who've been doing that for years, suddenly this thing comes along and doesn't, it must be a real trauma for them to say, well,
yeah,
how do I make sense of, like you say, the value of my work? Mm-hmm. When things like that happen, or coal miners in this country fought tooth and nail to keep their jobs when it was actually uneconomic, and if you get much cheaper open cast coal from abroad with the machines staggered out rather than men underground.
Mm-hmm.
But they were still fighting for their jobs. And so my other question is to do with, is there a right to work? And does society have a responsibility to give work to people? So that's a related issue.
Yeah, so it's an interesting idea. Do people have the right to work? Or does society have the responsibility? I think I'm not sure on the right side of things, but I would say that, in my opinion, society, and especially if you're a Christian, the idea you have a responsibility, yes, to engage people and allow them to be engaged in work. That's because essentially I think this is a core way of essentially allowing them work. And again, we're talking primarily about paid work here, so there are different types of work, but I think that is a large part of being human, of contributing to society. And there's actually a lot of work done the mental health of the unemployed is awful because it is a traumatic state to be in. So it's not that, oh, we're out of work, you're going to be great. No, that's not what happens to people when they're out of work. If they're being paid for, they struggle because people, I think, inherently want to be engaged in society, in the world in some way. So I think that we should definitely review that as a responsibility.
But isn't that more of almost like a governmental responsibility rather than the personal one? I don't walk around every day thinking, now, how can I create work for people? That's my big responsibility in life.
Mm.
I don't think that way. I think, okay, I need actually workers to fulfill my objectives,
mm-hmm.
you know, and but I think people think they have a right to work, and therefore, if they haven't got it, government has a responsibility to provide it.
Mm.
I know we're into another area a bit.
It is interesting, but I like, actually, it's interesting what you said, but you say, I don't feel like I have the responsibility to walk around giving people work. I need to find workers for this. But actually, I would say that, again, this is that idea of seeing all work as part of the body in the sense that, yeah, that we're not all, for instance, we don't all own businesses, so therefore the ultimate idea of employment isn't in our hands, really. We might be managers in that way, but I would say people who do have that kind of that responsibility of employment and being able to be creative and make choices, I think if you talk to any business owner, employment is the number one kind of question of it, finding good people and creating a good environment for them as one of your main responsibilities in that. It's not just, I need to make this product as good as possible and I'm going to use everything along the way, whether that's people or the environment or anything. It's to say that I need to find the best way to get to that outcome, which means I don't just employ anybody. You're right. You don't just create 10 slots in your organization just because it's good for people to be employed. But you should be thinking about that as part of the good of what you're doing, okay, of employing people, helping them find a good fit for them and creating a good environment for them. So I think in that way, yeah, each of us doesn't need to walk around thinking about how we're going to create a job for somebody else. But if you have that, either that capacity to be an entrepreneur, to start a business, it's interesting, I think, coming from an American context and with a family, my father was an entrepreneur. He owned small businesses. So actually, we talk a lot in our family about offering people employment and kind of how you do that well, you know, and what that should look like. What are your responsibilities to a worker and what are their responsibilities to you? And how do you make the hard decisions of firing people at times or letting them go? So, and that,
that was secondary, though, to perhaps making money or whatever. You know, that was his main objective. So, yeah, I've got this ideal I like to see it from fruition because it's a worthwhile thing. You know, the employment, is, I mean, it's necessary, and when you have to do it responsibly. You know, I was a head teacher and I had a lot of employees in that school. And I, you know, in fact, how they were employed was very important. Indeed, the whole function.
Yeah. School.
But I didn't. The school wasn't set up to employ people.
No, no. That. Yeah. The school. The point of the school.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think the more you actually take the pressure off the work for, like I said, these things like identity and fulfillment and a lot of other things, the more I think we're freed to actually pursue the work itself. To say, well, what is in that school? What does a good school look like? How do you create? How do you? What is it trying to? It's trying to educate students. What does that look like? So the more you're freed to look at that, I think, and then you make wise decisions about, well, how many people does that take? What roles in that way? I think that's then also going to create kind of the design of the work in that scenario where you're actually thinking about the thing itself that you're doing is going to be better then. You're not going to have people in roles that don't really make sense because they're just part of a bureaucracy. You're going to have people in roles that have true responsibility and meaning to them because they're going to be doing something. So I absolutely think you need to think about the actual work that is being done and try to think, what does that look like to do that well in a holistic sense of creating and stewarding humanity and creation, all of it, you know, and not just taking advantage of one for the other. That makes sense. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, Katie?
Hey, yeah, I really like this matrix, and I'll probably find myself referring back to it. So thanks for that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know whether it would be a third dimension or whether somehow it's connected to design, but the question that keeps coming to my mind is, in both of your examples, I can imagine completely different scenarios based on workplace environment, based on things like bureaucracy, organizational politics, good or bad relationships within the workplace. And it seems like that can really make or break everything on here.
Yeah.
So where do you see that fitting in?
Yeah, good question. So the question for those on the recording is the idea of where does like workplace environment fit into this? I would put that squarely in the design or structure of your work. The other word is the structure in the sense of like, what where does it look like where you actually are the work that you're doing there? So I would put that squarely. That's part of what I'm talking about in that way. Because I had that thought squarely when I was thinking about that. It's not just like, oh, the work is, you're not just working a lot of hours, but where are you working? What is the environment there? What is expected of you? Yeah,
so,
in that way.
In the example of the graphic designer where she's trying to decide this as a career,
yeah.
Would that be part of the, like, maybe you were just not in an empowering office and you should have an office that's more empowering?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what I think. And I think that's part of where probably what I heard, and she may listen to lecture, so I need to be sensitive, but what I heard was this idea of this is kind of me, like it wasn't engaging me, it's meaningless. But no, that's, and we heard that actually in an example as well of like, we need to be careful about evaluating work as meaningless based on your experience of it. Okay, and in the same way in this sense of like her, I think it was probably fine for her to find a different employment because it wasn't engaging. It didn't seem like she could find other employment, and two, it wasn't challenging her. It wasn't a great place. So I think you're exactly right. When we look at this, that's why I wanted all these areas. We can start to look at the different dimensions of work. It may be like I see a lot of people working for charities where from a service point of view, it's beautiful what's being done, but actually structurally, it's awful. They're poorly run places and they're bad places to work because you're only thinking about the service there and you're not looking at this holistic idea of the environment. So that's part of what I wanted to kind of combat is like, well, if I work for a nonprofit, I'll lead a meaningful, fulfilled, and happy life. It's not kind of automatically there just because it has a good outcome and it's service oriented, if that makes sense.
So, I guess like with those things in mind, as well as just this reality that all, like either the work itself or the systems it's operating in, are going to be fallen. Like, I don't know if is there something else besides like lamenting, or like lamenting is important, but
And it's good to know that we can be growing in virtue and, you know, confronting vices and developing capacities in those things. But I think sometimes it's hard, like, up against just a really broken system to feel like that's still good and that wouldn't necessarily go away if you're in a better office. So, like, and it could be a good field, like, in terms of, like, it sounds good. So, like, healthcare or something.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a really broken system.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe a lot of the work that you're doing is providing jobs to people who don't need them or are addicted to them. And it's, like, that's kind of just the nature of the system in certain aspects. And that's not the only part.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a response as Christians that we can have beyond just lamenting? Because it's, you want to do something, not just feel it.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a question about what do, how can we go beyond lamenting when you see kind of the structural kind of brokenness of places, of workplaces and systems, whole systems. You talk about healthcare, an example. Absolutely, 100%. And I think that's where this, as Christians, where we have to raise most of the conversation about work. Every book I read in this starts with examples of people saying, all anybody ever told me about being a Christian worker was basically to be nice to your coworkers and maybe tell them about Jesus. So it was this very idea, this idea of personal morality was as big as it got. So if you can be good, and it's almost like you're looking at yourself and that, or looking after yourself and that kind. Well, just be good and don't get too tainted. But actually, like Christ, his work, as I say, it's restorative over all creation. So as Christians, we are participating in that on a macro level. And that's where I think we need to be thinking about, not just in my space, it's that, how do I kind of behave and act in a loving way, but how do we redeem the spaces that we're in? And I see a lot of, there's something like, I read in one book, over 1,200 kind of lay-led faith and work organizations in the world right now. This is a growing field, almost all led by lay people, so not from the church or anything like that, of people asking these questions of, but what I think where it's most encouraging is you need to find people that are also, find other Christians in the same space to talk about these things, to both evaluate, to say, well, to, I think, to identify, well, what are some of the idolatries that we might have in this, but also what are some of the opportunities that we have in doing this? Where that's why I say part of this is evaluating your own work, part of it saying, well, where, what needs to be restored in this work? So it's, this isn't the end of it. This is just a kind of an evaluating matrix that then should lead you to more other behavior, to saying, well, I would like to redeem the way that you know, graphic design work is often isolating for people. So what can I do around creating community and connection for graphic designers that are all working from home? You know, so identifying those opportunities for redemption and participating in that. So is that helpful? Does that answer your question? I think it depends on, I mean, the specific answer is absolutely going to depend on your context, which is why I think work, the topic of work, is often hard to preach from the pulpit on, because it's so unique to everybody's situation. And again, which is why I want to give framework so that you guys can go away and think a little bit more deeply on your own. Because I can't say, you know, we could have all graphic designers in here and this is going to get filled out differently 60 times over, you know, in that way. So yes?
Very good talk, thank you. You talked for about an hour on work, and I don't think I heard the word profit once.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a pervasive idea in industry and organizations that, in fact, the idea of a public stock company is to make profits for its shareholders. I don't really have a specific question around this, but I'd like to get your general thoughts on the whole profit motive that's so pervasive in our economy and how this cuts across what you're saying about work.
Yeah, so what is thoughts on profit? I didn't mention it all in here. Yeah, I think Peter Drucker had a really... good quote, and he said, "Profit is it's like the air we breathe, in the sense that we don't live to breathe; we breathe to live." Okay, so profit is a part of what needs to happen to keep something going, but it's not the goal. It's not the purpose. It shouldn't be the purpose of an organization. So I think that's where it goes wrong. It's not that profit is bad. You need profit to reinvest in a company, to grow it, to do better things. Okay, profit's okay. But if that's the only goal, then I think then you start to lose track of all these other areas where you need to be caring for and stewarding people or the environment, or you need to be thinking more about what's the actual thing you're making than will it make money. So it's, yeah, I would say that profit in and of itself is a means. It's fine in that way. I think it's kind of goes to the idea of when it becomes the ultimate, when we raise it to the ultimate thing, that's when it starts to distort other decisions. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But it is in, certainly in many of the organizations we work in, it is the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
And not just of the organizations, but often the personal goals of the people around them.
Yeah.
That's the water they swim in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I think that kind of that narrative I told of individual fulfillment, I think you have to, it's not so much that, like, you know, making money isn't bad. Being fulfilled isn't bad. It's when that becomes your only goal. When you first asked, will this make me money, as opposed to, is this job useful to anybody? You know, and unfortunately, there are a lot of jobs in our society that are the most lucrative, have the most questionable, like, what are they even doing? As a book that I don't know if I would recommend it, but just the fact that it was written, called Bullshit Jobs. And it was just talking about that tendency towards this proliferation of seemingly meaningless jobs where no one can actually figure out what these roles are doing, but they seem to be making the most money. And again, I don't think I'd recommend it. The reviews I read said it was mainly just him complaining. But the idea was, I thought, yeah, there's a lot of times where someone talks about their job, and you're like, what does that even mean? You know, and sometimes that's because it's specialized, so I want to be sensitive. Sometimes, though, I think, not sure. Other questions? Thoughts? Yeah, in the back.
Kind of related to the profit question, mm-hmm. You said that one of the functions of profit is for growth. And it brought to mind something that cuts right back to the very beginning when you're talking the N.T. Wright quote about what narrative you're living in.
Mm-hmm. Continuity or
maintenance comes up.
Continuity.
So you lean towards growth, the ideal of the goal.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking also about factory work, you know, mm-hmm. saying sustaining the family, is that good enough?
Yeah.
Where in all of these various narratives is the narrative of passing the torch of human life and family forwards?
Yeah.
The less flashy, shiny version of the purpose and the goal.
So
maintenance, continuity, sustaining.
Okay, yeah, so where in this is this idea of sustaining life, maybe even between generations, or just maintaining creation, kind of that not growing it, but maintaining. Yeah, so actually it's a really good question, because...
The repetitive nature of the factory thing, that there might be a really powerful virtue being expressed and practiced in that, which is that being willing to be dutiful, persevering, continuation.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good concept, because I think, especially post-fall, the majority of the work we're doing is simply, I think, mitigating the fall. It's just dealing with, like, we're not getting ahead. We're just trying to mitigate the effects of the fall. And we know God's also doing that for us, on behalf of us, okay? It could be much worse. But we are, so much of our work is just trying to keep our heads above water as the whole of creation. So that's a great point of, like, that yes, that's where I say these kind of, especially these bottom categories, are quite grand in the sense that what I'm trying to do is plug into original intent, and then on the top here, deal with the reality post-fall. But yeah, a lot of work is just maintenance. It's just trying to kind of, I mean, you think of somebody in one sense who's very literally a maintenance worker, okay? This is part of my role at LaBrie, is just trying to kind of keep it going. We are not looking to add on anything. That I'm aware of, at least, to the manor. We just want it to function for another day, and that's in some ways dealing with the entropy and the decay of creation, and that's a good, positive thing. I would still, to a degree, put that under the idea of cultivation, in the sense that it's losing ground, and you're having to work it just to stay, so in one way, you're still building, you're still moving forward in that way, but the idea of, you talked also about kind of almost survival, of just like, you know, caring for, and again, I'll put that on the same. There are a lot of different phases of life, okay, and a lot of different responsibilities, and that's where we can't say that, like, I am a LaBrie worker, and that 100% defines who I am. No, I'm a LaBrie worker, or I will be. Andy is, at least, and okay, Andy is a father, and a husband and a friend, and we have these many different roles and responsibilities, okay, and we have to look at the whole of our life. A lot of those are types of work, okay, some of them aren't, but they're these social roles. That's why I defined it as a social role with duties and responsibilities that we're exercising. So, yeah, that's the difficult part of saying, well, what this work maybe doesn't seem that meaningful to me, but given the opportunities that I have in front of me, I mean, we are embodied creatures, and a lot of times I think we're trying to make these decisions about work regardless of where we live, what skills we have, or what's going on in the world. We're just kind of theoretically, what's good work? Where am I? As opposed to looking around and saying, well, what work is actually available? Okay, what do I, how can I actually engage with that? And then what responsibilities do I have? And for some phases of life, you need to focus more on like, well, I have to get work that at least allows me to care for my family right now. And then as we get through that phase, maybe I can start to look more outward and upward towards other things. But that's a wonderful goal to have accomplished, to care for your family. You know, that's not a small thing. And Paul even talks about that in Thessalonians, of basically that idea of like, you know, you need to look, part of loving others is to look after yourself. Okay, it is to fulfill that basic criteria of if you work, you need to work to be engaged, okay, to try, and that's part of it. But that can be overdone in, I think, a culture of kind of independence and self-reliance as the ultimate goal. So, William, yeah.
We're in an age where things are changing rather very fast, and the current buzzword is productivity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, productivity just means that individuals produce more and more and more, to the point where robots are now coming in to do that.
Mm-hmm.
To that effect, I've heard some experts, some in America, saying that we need to prepare ourselves in the future for a situation where people are actually paid not to work because all the work will be done by robots. How do we prepare the future generations for a life like that, where you can't go to work, but you're expected to purchase stuff, and therefore you're being paid to purchase stuff?
Well, I would probably start, we're talking about how we prepare for these kind of future ideas where maybe you know, productivity is put as the ultimate goal. So robot, you're kind of describing this idea that robots would take over a lot of work. One, it's interesting to say that has been forecasted before in society and not come true.
Yeah.
This idea that we're just going to all become kind of leisure-filled consumers, and it's never worked. We have a pretty insatiable appetite, it seems like. And so more goods are going, people are going to want more goods, and those goods have to be created. So I don't know, that the whole premise that someday we won't have to work because of technology. What seems to be happening actually is, as technology develops, more and more jobs are created to deal with that and the complexities of a society where they exist. Society is just becoming more and more complex, and it takes more and more people to deal with that in different ways. So I guess I would challenge the message itself. I agree with you, the idea that sometimes productivity is put at the top of the list, and that's not new. You read anything about the Industrial Revolution, and that is, again, it's scary decisions were made based on math and science of how fast things were done, and it was awful working conditions. I mean, that's the history of work is another kind of topic I would love to delve into, because it's not as bad as it has been in some ways, in some places in the world, I should say. What maybe actually let's say it's 9:32. Let's wrap it up there. Thank you all, and have a good day.